in free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
And welcome, everybody. It is Thursday, April 10th, 2014. We're talking to Bob Murphy today. We're finally finding the time to talk about his book, Chaos Theory. It's a little book. You can read it in no time at all. But this is a little book with big ideas. I don't like reading books that have a lot of filler, and I learned three things in them, and I've spent 5 hours reading them. First of all, that was a stupid waste of my time. If I wasn't learning anything, I should have stopped reading that book. That's a piece of advice that I have for you, by the way. If you start reading a book and it's not doing anything for you, I think some of us feel like we have a grim duty to carry on reading it to the end. You don't. You don't. You have a limited time on Earth. Toss that book in the garbage can. But not this one. Not Chaos Theory. It's a great book. Bob, of course, is a regular guest on this program. You all know that he is the author of The Politically Incorrect Guide to Capitalism, The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Great Depression and the New Deal, Lessons for the Young Economist, which you can Google and get for free. It's a textbook in economics for young people. He's also written study guides for the major Austrian economics treatises like Human Action and the Theory of Money and Credit by Mises and Man, Economy, and State by Rothbard. He blogs at consultingbyrpm.com. Bob, welcome back to the program once again.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So finally, you've been boring enough in between shows that I don't have to talk about something on your blog. That's not really true. I love your blog, and it's always interesting. But finally, a program on your book from 8 gazillion years ago called Chaos Theory, which you admit you named it that because it's a cool-sounding title, not because it actually has to do with chaos theory per se. The subtitle is Two Essays on Market Anarchy, and it couldn't be simpler. One of them's private law, and one of them's private defense. And before we started recording, I was telling you that yesterday I had Mark Perry from AEI on to talk about Equal Pay Day. I had no idea, actually, that it was Equal Pay Day. I bluffed my way through that, pretending. I was pretending for you guys that I knew it was Equal Pay Day, and we arranged it that way. And so Bob said, well, did you know that today's Police Privatization Day. Like, that was good. Like, that was really good. Because that's sort of what we're talking about. But let's start off with the private law stuff. They're both difficult topics. Let's start off with private law. That's how you start off in your book. These are the areas where people think you have to have government, and they can't see how society could function otherwise. And you give, I think, the most persuasive demonstration of how things would be likely to work, certainly that I've ever read. So let's get into the private law thing. First of all, just from a bird's eye view, just an overview of the subject, how does private law work? Do you mean that we have a private U.S. Congress that just churns out laws that we voluntarily agree to abide by? What does private law consist of?
Well, I think the first thing to get people warmed up to think about it is to just refresh your memory as to why don't we like government monopolies in other areas where we can conceive of what a private alternative would look like. So you don't want to have the government monopolizing the production of cars or computers or food, things like that, and you just rail through, well, why wouldn't you want that? Well, because the quality would be bad. They would have no incentive to serve their customer. Especially if it was something really important like food, that would just be monstrous to have the government monopolize that because people would have no choice but to take whatever the government gave them or else they'd starve to death. The prices would be really high and so on. You can see the benefits of bringing in competition in those arenas, and that's just standard. Everybody should see that in 2 seconds. And so the first thing to point out is everything that's bad about government monopolies in those other areas is also true of government provision of police services and judicial rulings. And we see that with our, if you just think about it for a second, I mean, there's cases of police brutality, there's corrupt judges, there's all sorts of things that people just take as a fact of life. And, well, that's the way it is. You know, although, you know, you got to have police. And so if the police shoot some unarmed man 57 times and they don't even get in trouble for it, well, you know, that's just the price we pay to have people fighting crime. And so there should be this sliver of doubt, I'm hoping to raise in people's minds, saying, does the system have to be like that, or is there a way we can bring in all the benefits of competition that we see elsewhere? So that's, you know, so people should be wanting to see how could there be a better way, and now we just have to try to show them and sketch a framework and say, what would private law look like? So to finally now address your specific question, I think one way to look at this is just to realize what is it that judges actually do, and that is that they render an opinion, right? And that's actually the terminology that we still have, that when a judge makes a ruling, it's called, the opinion of, if it's a divided thing, it's the opinion of the majority or what have you. And so it's the judge giving an opinion. And so ultimately, there's still this idea that we retain that the law is this objective thing that's out there, and that the judge is just an expert who comes in and renders his or her opinion on what the law says for a particular case. And for me, that's kind of the starting point, that when people have disputes, no matter what kind of social arrangement you're going to have, people will have disputes, even well-meaning people, over contracts or over, you know, someone alleges that somebody else stole his property or committed violence against him. And so they need to settle that in a public forum. And so that's what a judge does. You go to the court and you say both sides present their cases, and then the judge is supposed to render a neutral opinion on the case and who the judge thinks is in the right and in the wrong on this case as the law dictates.
Well, when we look at the evolution of law in the Western world, we note before we had legislatures every year producing, churning out reams of legislation, we instead had courts that more or less did what you're saying, that rendered opinions, and then these opinions over time began to form a body of law that everybody recognized, that gave a certain predictability to human activity and so on. But those nevertheless were government courts all the same. So are you saying that in a private law system there would be an analogous situation, except the courts would be private courts with private judges that would operate on the basis of trying to establish a reputation for fairness so that they could get more and more customers?
Yes, I am saying that, and it's the historical record, though, in terms of jurisprudence, it's actually a little bit more nuanced. One distinction I think we need to make is that between law and legislation. Okay, and so this is a point that Hayek talked about, but he wasn't the first to note it, that there is this distinction. If you look through human history and the way legal theorists would write about the law, the idea that, so there had to be law. I mean, humans have known about this thing called law going way back. I mean, you need, in order to have civilization, there has to be a set of norms and rules, and people have to believe that there are things that you just can't do. And they just to say, oh, well, that would be illegal. There has to be that set of rules that people, most people in society abide by. Otherwise, it would just break down. You can't have people walking around thinking cannibalism is fine. That just wouldn't work. You couldn't have society like that. So the idea of law, that there's a bunch of rules that you just can't violate in a civilized society, that's very ancient. But this idea of legislation, that humans have the competence and the authority to just make up what those rules are and to tweak them in order to improve society, that's a fairly recent innovation. Okay, so that's one thing that we should keep in mind when we think about historically how this developed. But you're right. So the basic idea is, and what would it look like to have a private law society, is that there would be competing judges. And so when people had disputes, both parties to the dispute would bring it before a judge that they agreed upon. And so the judges would be competing, that they would be vying in the service of providing legal opinions. So the judges would be competing against each other, and then and cases, you know, the vast majority of cases, it would be both parties would agree and pick the same judge. So just like, I mean, and you see this, this happens all the time right now, so this isn't science fiction stuff, that when businesses have disputes with each other, they very rarely literally take it to a government court. Usually they decide in arbitration because that's just so much quicker. And when there's, you know, divorces and things like that, I mean, in most cases, people do not want to actually go to a government court because they just know they're going to run up huge legal bills. It's going to take forever. They want to get a reasonably fair ruling quickly without spending too much money. And so that's why they take it to outside private arbitration. So I'm saying, ideally, you would just codify that system in its entirety. And so that you wouldn't need this government judge to rubber stamp the agreement that the parties had actually hammered out under private arbitration. And so all the benefits of competition would accrue in this sphere as well, that the only way a judge could stay in bit, like if there were a judge who just was notorious for always siding with the plaintiff, well, then the people who were accused of things wouldn't ever agree to pick that judge. And so that person would go out of business. And likewise, if somebody always was bending over backwards, taking the side of the defendant in a case, saying, oh, well, his parents abused him or, but had, well, then no plaintiff would ever agree to that judge to hear the case. And so there would arise a market, and judges would get a reputation for actually being fair and just. And that's how they would stay in business. And so, and there would be a standard for that. And so I think empirically, the reason people don't might think that wouldn't work is they're going to say, oh, well, how could anybody ever agree on having a fair judge? They would always just want the judge that was going to be sympathetic to their perspective, but we just see that's not true. Empirically, it does work. There is private arbitration. Companies, when they have disputes with their employees and so forth, and they have clauses in the contract saying private arbitration, they go to these people, and it's not like there's widespread allegations of unfairness, that if there is a market for arbitration services, the way you stay in business is by having a reputation of doing a fair job of it.
That's right. And of course, it's easier now to make these kinds of arguments now that there is a fully developed system of private arbitration in the United States. You don't have to appeal to people's imaginations. You can say, look around you. And I could imagine 50 years ago, somebody making this argument and being laughed at and being told there could never be private arbitration because of these 12 reasons. But now, who are you going to believe? That guy or your own eyes? They're actually out there. But then also, you suggest in this book that in my ordinary dealings every day, the stores that I visit, the restaurants that I visit, there would be a kind of a hybrid of an implicit and an explicit contract between us. Implicit in the sense that I don't expressly sign anything every time I walk into a restaurant, but explicit in that it's sitting right there available for me to see at any time, that if I cause damage to that restaurant or I steal from them according to the satisfaction of some arbitration agency, if to their satisfaction they believe I have stolen, then I consent to have the case heard by this or that arbitrator. And so in advance, these things are already taken care of.
Right, that's the way I'm trying to get around the issue of or address the issue of, well, gee, how do we have rules and yet not violate somebody's liberty? And so I'm saying, well, ideally, people who interact with each other would have agreed upon that framework in advance. And so clearly, things like if you're going to rent a car from some company, or you're going to rent an apartment, or you're applying for a job, clearly all those things where you're literally signing contracts with people, there would be clauses in there saying things to the effect of, you know, this contract will be governed by the interpretation or the rule book as codified by such, you know, ACME legal agency, and the list of arbitrators as maintained on this website here of arbitrators in good standing with the community. And if there's a dispute, the two signers to this agreement will select a mutually agreeable arbitrator from that list, you know, that sort of thing, so that nobody can say after the fact, oh, wait a minute, I never agreed to this and claim that they're being imposed upon, but they can say, well, no, you agreed to this beforehand. So that would be the ideal arrangement, where anybody who interacts with other people, ideally everything would have been endorsed beforehand. And then, as you said, in the interest of brevity, I mean, you're not going to literally sign contracts every time. Just like when you go into a restaurant and you sit down and you order, you know, forget about anarcho-capitalism for a second. I'm just normal free market scenarios. When you go into a restaurant, sit down and order, I mean, they can't just come up and then give you a bill and say, oh, we're charging you $50 for sitting there, and then we're also going to charge you on top, you know, for the food you ordered, that you would say, well, are we talking about? I never agreed to that. So there's some inkling of the community expectations and what that entails. But on the other hand, if you ordered something and then you later said, you know what, and give me a piece of pie as well, and you didn't actually see the menu, and then they gave it to you, you wouldn't be able to claim after the fact, well, you actually didn't tell me how much it cost, so I'm not paying you anything for that pie. You see what I mean? So there's all sorts of norms that are built in social expectations as to what is happening when people engage in commercial transactions without having to explicitly sign a contract. And so to connect with what you were saying, I tried to argue in Chaos Theory the same sort of thing, that when you enter a shopping mall, I mean, they could have a sign posted perhaps, but it would be understood that, hey, we subscribe to the community norms as to the type of laws governing what happens when you enter this mall, and so you're implicitly endorsing that when you come onto our property.
Now, you also use this kind of analysis to explain how it could be legitimate, how it could work out that a wrongdoer could be taken off to prison, that in a sense, he has consented to this in a similar way.
Yeah, I think this is the one that intrigues people the most. So that, yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. Let's just walk through this one. So the issue is, okay, you guys are obviously pining for a really free society, and yet the problem is, what if there's a serial killer? What if there's, you know, people doing clearly antisocial things, and they're not going to sign contracts beforehand and say, well, if I am convicted of serial killing, then I agree to such and such. You know, so what do you do about things like that? And don't we have to at some point just arbitrarily say, well, we're going to violate this person's bodily integrity because he violated a bunch of rules that we think are important, whether or not he agrees to them? So the way I try to handle these really nightmarish scenarios is to say, okay, first of all, in a truly free society along the lines that somebody like Murray Rothbard would have pictured, every piece of property is privately owned. So there's no such thing as so-called public land. And so no matter where you're standing, you are physically on somebody's property. Now, if it's your own house, then you're standing on your own land. But in general, you are on somebody else's property in such a society. And so if somebody really is, let's say that there's a serial killer, and the victims bring the evidence, they call the detective agencies and so forth, and they present evidence in various courts. They say to the public, hey, we think this guy's a serial killer. He doesn't show up to his defense, and so there's not an issue of him choosing the arbitrator, or he just refuses to show up and say, no, those guys are all crooked. And so in various courts with reputable arbitrators, judges all agree that, yes, the evidence beyond a shadow of a doubt says this guy's a serial killer. We've got video surveillance. Okay, so the community now has labeled this guy as a pariah. It is well known that he is a convicted serial killer, but still he's just walking around because he's crazy. And so what happens? Well, I'm saying there doesn't have to need to be any pre-existing contractual arrangements between the various members of the community. They all own the sidewalks and the roads and the shopping malls and so forth. So everybody in the community who's been alerted to who this guy is can say, you are not allowed on my property, right? You don't need to have a contract with someone to be able to say, get off my land. And so the point is, no matter where he is standing, he is going to be violating somebody's wishes and be on their property. So everybody says, get off my property. And so where is he going to end up? Well, that's now where I'm saying you can see the so-called private prisons, that there could be, you can imagine companies building facilities that could contain violent individuals, and they could just have an outstanding offer to these pariahs and say, you can come onto our property, but we have certain rules you have to abide by. Of course, we're going to search you when you get here to make sure you don't have weapons. We have specially trained staff, you're going to say, in certain types of rooms where there's not going to be steak knives lying around and that sort of thing. We're going to perhaps make you see counselors, whatever it may be. But we're going to give you a cubicle where you can work. If you're a brilliant engineer or something, you can still do that. We're not going to have you do something silly like make license plates or smash rocks that does no, you know, serves no purpose to anybody. And if there is this pending judgment against you that you owe somebody $600,000 because of all the crimes you committed, well, then you can come here and work that off over time. And that, so we're giving you this opportunity to do that. And, of course, we're going to charge you a fee for this, and we'll deduct that out of the amount that we allow you to work. But, you know, as it is right now, no one's going to sell you food. There's no one, electricity companies aren't going to deal with you. You're going to just be an outlaw running for your life unless you come in here where you know you'll be safe. And the other thing is, these prison companies would compete with each other for the inmates, right? Because you would have the right to leave and go to a separate facility. So the guards couldn't be sadistic in these organizations, because if they were, the inmates would just go somewhere else that says, we welcome outlaws here. You just have to follow our rules if you want to stay here. So that's the framework that I'm picturing, that it's not so much that, oh, we have some agency that goes and grabs people and physically drags them off and puts them in jail according to a bunch of rules they never agreed to. It's that everybody says, or most people in the community say, if you're a convicted murderer, then get the heck off of my land, which, of course, they have the right to say to anybody. And then these so-called private prisons would arise to say, we're an oasis for people like you to rehabilitate you and so forth. And they're doing it to make money. It's a profit-making business.
Now, you're envisioning a system in which people would take out insurance that would help in case, let's say, they were found liable for some damages or something. They may have caused some damage by accident. They don't have to be out-and-out criminals, but people would be carrying policies of some sort. Can you flesh that out?
Yeah. So this is, just to alert your listeners, this is the one area where I kind of deviate from the standard Rothbardian tradition. So I just want to make sure they realize that. The other stuff you and I have been talking about, I think most people would say that what I'm saying has been compatible, at least, with the way somebody like Murray Roth or Hans Hoppe would have described it. So, but what I'm about to talk about right now is a twist on that, and so just want to make your listeners aware of that. So, thus far, we've sort of painted this picture where private judges would render an opinion and say, this is what we think the law says in this situation. And so the problem is, okay, well, let's say somebody, some husband gets drunk and he comes home and he sees his wife cheating with his best friend and he shoots them both. Okay, and so then, oh man, the estates of the victims come and or the relatives, and they bring the case before the judge, and the judge says, yep, you're guilty, you owe $300,000 to each of the victims, and that's my ruling. And so the problem is, well, what if he doesn't have $600,000 on him? He probably won't. Most people aren't going to be walking around with that kind of money. And so what I said is, there would be a role to have insurance for these types of contingencies. And so to the extent that everybody is insured, then you know the victims of crimes are going to be indemnified immediately. The insurance company is going to pay them, and then it's just an issue of the insurance companies dealing with, you know, their client who caused the transgression and was the reason to trigger the payout. And so when you hear that, at first it sounds kind of pie in the sky, but my point is, and I made the issue in chaos theory, is that, well, wait a minute, we see examples of this all the time right now in the real world. So the most obvious one is medical malpractice suits for surgeons, that in order for you to be a doctor and work at a reputable clinic or hospital, you have to carry medical malpractice insurance, so that if you do something wrong on the operating table and kill the patient, and then you are found guilty, and then you owe a bunch of money to the estate of the person you killed, even though you're a doctor and have a bunch of money, maybe you don't have that much, and so the insurance pays for it. So that's a precondition to be able to work at the hospitals, to carry that kind of insurance. Or just to be able to drive on the road, you have to have automobile insurance. Now, that's technically required by the state, but you can easily imagine privately owned roads having a similar requirement, saying if you're going to come onto our road knowing that you're agreeing that if you smash into somebody recklessly that you owe them a bunch of money, well, we want to make sure you actually have the ability to pay that kind of money, and so we're going to check to make sure you have insurance to be able to ride on our privately owned road. Okay, so you can see that kind of mechanism. So by the same token, if you apply to be an employee somewhere, the company could say, we want you to have a policy with a reputable insurance company saying, if you come out of the work site one day and go nuts and start killing people, well, then we know that you're covered and your insurance is actually going to pay the liabilities for that. and pay off the, you know, the families of the victims and that sort of thing. And so that kind of framework, I think, is what would happen in a large civilized society where most people would have insurance like that, and the insurance would be pretty cheap for most cases, since most people aren't going to be criminals, and so actuarially, the insurance company doesn't need to charge a lot for homicide insurance, okay, because very few of their clients are actually going to be convicted of homicide. And also then, it gives the insurance companies the motivation to actually investigate these people. So that's the thing. And part of why I like this idea is it kind of solves the problem of, well, gee, you know, some random stranger wanders into a city who's never been there before, and in your libertarian utopia, how the heck are the store owners and the apartment owners and things like that, how are they supposed to know who this guy is? They got to go do background checks on everybody and spend a bunch. That just really, you know, there should just be the central agency that keeps tabs on everyone. And no, there doesn't need to be that. It's rather all they would have to do is say, before I let you rent an apartment here in my building, I want you to provide proof of that you've been insured by some reputable insurance company. So it's the insurance company that does the background check. And there's also competition there. If somebody has some blemish on his record that's unfair, that, you know, he's some agency reports that he was convicted of a crime in Albuquerque when actually it was some guy with his same name, but it wasn't him, well, then there's a profit opportunity there for some other insurance company to get it right and to give him the policy. So that's the basic framework, where I'm just kind of flipping it and saying people have insurance to indemnify others for crimes that they might be convicted of. And so that's the way you know that victims get paid immediately. In contrast to the present system, where if somebody, you know, kills a guy, the best that family is going to hope for usually is, oh, the government might take him and throw him in a cage. And that doesn't really help the family of the victim.
Bob, there's an analogy in your book also to between what you're saying here, in which the insurance companies play this important role, and a case like airline safety. People would say, in your libertarian utopia, oh, by the way, we never use the word utopia, and yet that's always thrown at us. In your libertarian utopia, everybody would have to investigate each airline and each airplane for himself for safety record, the qualifications of the pilots, and so on. And what you point out here is that, again, the insurance companies that have to pay out if there are crashes and so on, they're the ones who want to prevent crashes. They have skin in the game. They're the ones who are going to subject the airlines to inspections, and they're the ones who are going to require background checks to be performed on the pilots to the satisfaction of the insurance company. So there you make sure that there's a socially optimal amount of regulation placed on these airlines, because if there's too much regulation, if there's too little regulation, there are too many crashes, and the insurance company has to pay out too much, they go out of business. Too much, and the firm goes to another insurance company. And so this way, you balance it all out. Now, ultimately, the big question that will come back to you on this is, what about the enforcement agencies going to war with each other? What about the mafia taking over? And I want to take that up the next time we have you on, because what we'll do is, next time we'll finish up this topic. We'll go into the private defense question, but we'll finish up by getting into the real meat of it, because you've written a separate article on this general subject of, won't warlords just take over? Walter Block says it's one of the most useful and interesting and compelling articles on this subject ever. So we'll have you come talk about that next time. So in the meantime, you have to not talk about anything interesting on your blog so we don't get distracted. So in a couple of weeks, we can have you back on and finish this up. How does that sound?
Sounds great. I'll do my best to be boring.
All right. Very good, Bob. All right. That's Bob Murphy, everybody. The book is Chaos Theory, 2 Essays on Market Anarchy. You'd be crazy not to read this thing. Even if you don't think you're going to be convinced, you really should read it. I think our default position should not be, we need government monopolies for X, Y, and Z. That's a crummy default position. You could maybe reach that position if you really feel like you have exhaustively examined the alternatives, but only then. And you haven't exhaustively examined them until you've read Chaos Theory by Bob Murphy. All right, I very much hope you guys will follow Bob on his blog at consultingbyrpm.com/blog. This is a crazy week of travel for me this week, but I wanted to make sure We got some programs for you guys in my absence, so I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Bob today. Remember, help me celebrate 2 years of my LibertyClassroom.com by getting yourself a 50% off subscription. 50% off with coupon code DISCOUNT in all caps at LibertyClassroom.com. 9 courses you can listen to on the go, or you can watch them if you like sitting in front of a screen, but we got them in MP3 and MP4, plus Q&A forums and lots of fun events, recommended readings, etc. So LibertyClassroom.com, coupon code DISCOUNT in all caps. Next week, by the way, going to be talking to Larkin Rose. A lot of you guys said, you got to get this guy on, so we're doing it. Also going to be talking on Monday, if all goes well, to Gareth Porter about the Iranian nuclear program and the truth behind that. Then it's Dr. Mary Ruart in the middle of the week, so lots to enjoy next week. So make sure you are subscribing to the program on iTunes or Stitcher. You can find easy subscription links at TomWoodsRadio.com. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.